As a teacher, once you know why you do what you do and appreciate the importance of it, you're going to be so much more motivated during the year.
Preparing educators to return to the classroom. We feel the energy as we talk to school leaders bringing education to students in exciting ways.
Now is not the time for on-the-job training. We don't need to bring in a rookie. We don't need to bring in people without experience.
A stage full of Republican presidential hopefuls try to make their mark with voters during the first GOP primary debate. In this week's Synodal Series, a look at the potential impact of Eastern Rite Catholics on this October's Synod on Synodality meetings at the Vatican.
People are hungry for something. There's a moment, a timeliness in our culture where people are really looking for this kind of renewal.
And our talk with the executive director of the National Eucharistic Congress as we look ahead to an event designed to strengthen our relationship with Christ. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
The most important question that faces so many educators today is, why are we doing any of this? Why do we choose this subject instead of that? What's the purpose that we're trying to make? Are we trying to make just people who are going to work a job and then go home and buy things and that's their lives? Or are we trying to make people who have a higher purpose in life?
It's back to school time. Not only a time for students to get excited about the new year, but instructors too, as they prepare to mentor, teach, and guide those in their care. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. The anticipation of a new school year, new teachers, new classmates, new things to learn. Across the country, empty classrooms are being filled with students returning to elementary, secondary, and college classrooms. Today, we begin back-to-school coverage with a look at a training program for teachers in Potomac, Maryland, that is inspiring them as the school year starts to give their all in the classroom. Here's reporter Roselle Rages.
I felt that call really in my bones, like you're made to teach, and this is something truly noble to give yourself to.
Growing up, John Kish didn't think he would become a teacher. He was always interested in liberal arts and studied philosophy in college. After graduating, he was invited to attend a conference that eventually inspired him to teach.
I was told by a bunch of friends, you have to go to this, you need to check it out. I was like, do I want to be a teacher?
Kish attended the Teaching Vocation Conference hosted by the Heights Forum. The annual event held in Potomac, Maryland, is meant for men exploring professions as educators and provides a glimpse into the culture of the Heights School.
When I saw what the Heights men were doing with teaching, when I saw the love that they had for their students, the love for this vocation as really molding people into being the best that they can be to lead them closer to God, I fell in love.
Kish is now going on his second year of teaching at St. Benedict's Classical Academy in Natick, Massachusetts.
But I'm so excited to be able to meet my new students, to get to know them, and to spend so much time with them exploring during the school year.
Before the start of the school year, Kish went back to the high school to attend another conference about the importance of mentoring. Headmaster of the school, Alvaro De Vicente, describes mentoring as
conveying what it means to be a Christian gentleman and how would a Christian man deal with those situations.
De Vicente explains that this mentoring conference is an opportunity for educators and school leaders to learn how to serve as life coaches for their students. Some of the discussions included developing rapport and trust with our mentees, fostering our mentees' spiritual growth, and facilitating difficult conversations. As an all-boys school, De Vicente says mentoring is crucial.
You know, one of the challenges that we have in education is that we try to treat boys as if they were little kids, but we judge them as if they were grown-ups. I think we just tend to forget the mistakes that we made at their age. So we try to reverse that and treat them as grown-ups, put more responsibility on them, you know, pull them up by the way we deal with them, but then judge them as boys. Understand that they're going to make mistakes. They're going to be loud.
Serving as headmaster for more than 20 years, he shares what he believes makes for a great school year.
Really, what is the most important preparation, I think, for in the school, which is to get the faculty back together and remind each other why we're here. As a teacher, once you know why you do what you do and appreciate the importance of it, you're going to be so much more motivated.
DeVincenti is more than excited to welcome students again and to get the campus back to what he describes as high energy.
If you imagine 600 boys together in one space, it's, you know, it's going to feel high energy.
This is the kind of school culture Andy Perez-Benzo hopes to bring to Bedford, New York.
So the Hawthorne School began as a project of several families in the New York City area. These were families that wanted not only a high-caliber education for their children, but the formation of their character as well.
As a father of three and board member for the Hawthorne School, Perez-Benzo attended the mentoring conference, hoping to bring back what he learned.
Mentoring is one of the key ways that you can form the soul of a young man or a young woman and bring it to maturity so that that person can flourish in society. You know, as a mother, as a father, as a professional, and I think that's why we need it.
The Hawthorne School is only going on its second year, but Perez-Benzo says it is thriving. He wants students to learn how to live a life rooted in faith.
If we really believe that our faith is at the core of our own being, then we're going to be able to transmit the most important truths to a younger generation.
Russell Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
And it's back to the classroom in colleges and universities across the country, too. Many Catholic families looking for the right Catholic college for their children use the Newman Guide to help them decide on the best higher education institution for them. The colleges and universities listed below are the institutions that the Newman Guide recommends for their commitment to a faithful Catholic education in the United States. They include Ave Maria University, the Catholic University of America, Benedictine College, Thomas Aquinas, and Wyoming Catholic Colleges. You can visit the Newman Guide website for the full list, which includes schools outside of the United States and online. The newly named president of Wyoming Catholic College, Kyle Washut, joins us now to celebrate the start of the new school year. Congratulations, Kyle, on this new role for you. The school year kicks off at Wyoming Catholic in a really unique way. Tell us about it.
So all of our freshmen come about 3 weeks, 4 weeks before the semester starts for everyone else. And we do a 3-day wilderness first aid training, and then we send them up in groups into the Wind River and Absaroka Mountains, and they do a backpacking trip for 3 weeks. And at the end of the first 2 weeks, they're up there with a chaplain. They're learning the skills for reading maps, surviving in the wilderness. And at the end of those first 2 weeks, we break them into small groups, give them an X, tell them this is where the bus is going to meet them, and they hike their way out and return for the start of the semester.
That's amazing. You're an alum. Did you do this as well?
So I'm not an alum. I've just been here since the very beginning.
Okay.
And I did the very, very first course with the students. Yeah, went out there for three weeks with them and wandered around the Wind River Mountains, came home and kept ducking when I would walk inside.
Now, you also do something that speaks to this digital fatigue that many students experience. What policies do you have around technology on campus?
So the students get used to not having their cell phones, obviously, when they're up in the mountains for 3 weeks. When they come back, we ask them to check their cell phones into the student life office. We don't have Wi-Fi in the dorms. We have restricted internet access in other spots of campus. And we try to have as little screen time as possible for the student interactions and faculty interactions.
And has it always been this way?
From the beginning. So even before smartphones had really taken off, they were just starting, and we opened the school in 2007 with our first students. And from the beginning, we had no cell phone policy.
Now, because you have been there such a long time, how has the school changed over time in both the way that it forms young minds, but also maybe some of the ways that it's encountered the way that culture has changed with sexual morality being really something at the forefront of what you're facing on Catholic colleges?
Sure. So that's one of the things we really had to do, I think, is imagine what it's like when we have young men and women that grow up in a complete internet age. When we started in 2007, our freshmen were still born in the 90s at this point, right? All of our freshmen are born 2005 or later. And so growing up in the post-iPhone age with the ubiquity of pornography, with the concerns about transgender identity and the rest, the students have just been inundated with a series of propaganda and just a parade of images. Some of their parents have tried their best to keep them sheltered from that. But we've really been constantly reflecting on, all right, what do we need to do? Previously, it was enough just to say we're not going to have cell phones. But now we've got cellular connectivity with laptops and the rest. And how do you actually get a detox? How do you actually get a break? And how do you preserve just real authentic relationships between men and women? And that's been one of our real struggles. And I think we've made some real progress in that area.
Now, how is the Catholic identity so critical? How does that inform what you're doing? Is it just because you're Catholic or because you're also just a great educational institution?
Well, yes, both. I think those are both very true. The thing we tell our students is that we're offering an integrated education, and we use the slogan mind, body, spirit. But what we mean when we say an integrated education is we don't mean we do a Catholic thing over here and we do the mind thing over here and we do the body thing over here. Rather, we say, as a human person, everything you're doing involves your Catholic identity, it involves your mind, it involves your rationality, and it involves you as a physical being. So when you're out in the mountains, we're not just exercising, you're also praying and encountering God and reflecting within the Catholic intellectual tradition. When you're in the classroom, we're thinking with the mind of the church. When we're in our student dormitories, where we have rules of residence to prevent men from being in the women's dorm and women from being in the men's dorm and various things in accord with the Catholic identity that's infused through every aspect of the education.
Now, Kyle, many schools then boast their job placement rate post-graduation, and I'm sure that you do too, but Wyoming has a specific character to it. Two of your graduates run a successful software training company that also works in carpentry in the afternoons. What can you tell us about how this reflects the kind of individuals that you form?
So our students come to us because they want to be formed not just in one part of their life, not just in a very narrow vocational focus. They come because they desire an integrated formation. So it makes sense that a student comes out of here and is both capable of thinking about a tech software company that also integrates that with a life of prayer, that also wants to do some manual labor. Our students are aware of themselves being in their bodies, being in community, being Catholic, being reflective, intellectual beings, and they're going to constantly be looking for something to express all of those aspects.
Well, that's good to hear. You have a big mandate ahead of you. What do you hope to do with this new job that you've been given?
I am so excited to tell the world about Wyoming Catholic College. We are doing something utterly unique in the world of Catholic education. With our retreat into the wilderness, our encounter with Christ in that wilderness, our digital fasting, our great books, liberal arts education. This education only exists in Wyoming, and right now it's only for a very small group of students, and I want as many people as possible to hear about it and be able to participate in it in some way.
Well, we'll be praying for you as you endeavor to fulfill this great mission. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you so much, Monsi.
There's a lot more ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth, the Eucharistic Revival, our Synod on Synodality series, and politics.
I've had enough already tonight of a guy who sounds like ChatGPT standing up here. And the last person in one of these debates, Brett, who stood in the middle of the stage and said, "What's a skinny guy with an odd last name doing up here?" was Barack Obama, and I'm afraid we're dealing with the same type of amateur.
Some spirited moments during Wednesday's first Republican presidential primary debate. Our political coverage with a church perspective on the issues when we return.
This is exactly why Margaret Thatcher said, if you want something said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman.
With GOP frontrunner Donald Trump absent from the stage, the rest of the Republican presidential field tries to break out of the pack and gain traction with American voters. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. It was a crowded field on the debate stage in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on Wednesday night. Eight Republican challengers, some well-known, many not, sparring for airtime. Our focus here at EWTN News, politics and faith, and issues from a Catholic perspective. Here's reporter Mark Irons.
I have faith in the American people.
White House hopefuls in the Republican Party took to the debate stage this week.
Now is our moment to start running to something, to our vision of what it means to be an American today.
Making their pitch to the people.
We need to lower your gas prices. We're going to open up all energy production. We will be energy dominant again in this country.
There was the typical back and forth, including between former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and entrepreneur and political newcomer Vivek Ramaswamy, who stood alone in his support of cutting U.S. funding and military aid to Ukraine. Haley pushed back.
There you
have it.
Your watch,
so
you will make America less safe. You have no foreign policy experience, and it shows.
And you know what?
But what also showed up was the faith of some of the candidates and how it might influence their politics.
Well, our nation was founded upon the Judeo-Christian values that has made this the greatest nation on God's green earth. I'm a big believer in Ephesians 3:20 that God is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or imagine.
God is real. There are two genders.
Ramaswamy is Hindu, but he has said he shares Christian values. He also said faith could help in the response to a mental health crisis in the country.
But it's not just drugging up people in those psychiatric institutions with Zoloft and Seroquel. It's a deeper issue. I think faith-based approaches can play a role here, too.
Garnering support among conservative Christians could play a major role in deciding who the next Republican presidential nominee is. It paid off in 2016 for former President Donald Trump. He's leading substantially in current Republican polling and decided to skip out on Wednesday's debate. The former president is facing multiple criminal indictments. Chris Christie, a Catholic and the former governor of New Jersey, was a vocal opponent of Trump both during and after the debate.
Whether you agree or disagree with the criminal charges, do we really believe that this is normal behavior? Do we really think that this is what we want as a role model for our children and grandchildren? The clear answer is no.
Christie is currently in the minority for sharing his direct opposition to Trump, but the majority of Republicans on the debate stage had similar views on a number of issues, including immigration.
The most pressing need of the American people from a national security standpoint is our southern border.
U.S. Senator Tim Scott, just one voice among the Republican candidates advocating for a strong southern border and a stop to illegal immigration. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum says drug cartels have funneled opioids into the country and contributed to overdoses throughout America.
We've lost 200,000 people to overdoses since Biden took office. That's 300 people a day. We're taking mass casualties.
Support for unborn babies was also on display. Following the reversal of Roe v. Wade last summer, abortion law went back to the states. Governor Ron DeSantis, a Catholic, touting his record after signing a six-week abortion ban in Florida.
I believe in a culture of life. I was proud to sign the heartbeat bill.
Asa Hutchinson, the former governor of Arkansas, called his state the most pro-life.
I signed 30 pro-life pieces of legislation while I was governor.
And Mike Pence, a former Catholic, spoke about his own biblical convictions on the issue.
After I gave my life to Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, I opened up the book and I read, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you." And I've been a champion for life in the Congress, a champion for life as governor and as vice president.
Both Pence and Senator Scott showed support for a 15-week abortion ban at the federal level. But Nikki Haley suggested the support in Congress wouldn't be there.
We haven't had 45 pro-life senators in over 100 years, so no Republican president can ban abortions.
Haley, who described herself as unapologetically pro-life, spoke about the possibility of finding common ground.
Let's find consensus. Can't we all agree that we should ban late-term abortions? Can't we all agree that we should encourage adoptions? Can't we all agree that doctors and nurses who don't believe in abortion shouldn't have to perform them?
The road to the 2024 presidential election is now being paved, and both Republicans and Democrats will continue to try and capture voter support.
And so for Catholics, the concern right now would be,
to start paying attention.
And James Patterson, an associate professor and chair of the Department of Politics at Ave Maria University in Florida, gives some advice to Catholic voters as they consider all the issues being debated. For starters, go to Mass.
The teaching role of the church occurs most often at Mass. That is when you're supposed to be learning these things.
Patterson says it's a good place to form your conscience. Putting faith before politics is also something U.S. Catholic bishops have called for in their document on the political responsibility of Catholics, saying, quote, "For all Catholics, including those seeking public office, our participation in political parties or other groups to which we may belong should be influenced by our faith, not the other way around." Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
The next Republican presidential primary debate is scheduled for September 27th at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. The threshold to get on the stage will be higher. According to rules established by the Republican National Committee, each candidate will have to hit at least 3% in some key polls and have at least 50,000 unique donors. Stay with EWTN News for continued coverage of the presidential campaign as we bring a Catholic perspective to the issues. We will have candidate interviews, polling, and analysis, in addition to coverage of future debates. Top headlines are next in the Week in Review. A presidential visit to Hawaii. The Pope plans to add more to his encyclical about the environment and our responsibility to nature and each other. Analysis from our Vatican Bureau. And another bankruptcy in a major U.S. archdiocese. We'll be right back. An increasing number of people are now listed as missing following the deadly fires that swept through the historic area of Maui. More on that story tops the Week in Review. In an update this week, officials in Hawaii say that at least 1,100 people are unaccounted for following the fires that essentially wiped the tourist town of Lahaina off the map. More than 115 people are confirmed dead. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden toured the devastation on Monday, seeing for themselves blocks and blocks of hollowed out homes, burnt cars and singed trees left behind by the deadliest wildfire in the United States in more than a century. The couple met with the governor, U.S. senators, state and local officials and first responders. Identification of the dead has been slow, and the FBI is asking for relatives of the missing to provide DNA samples. But there are many rescue stories, which the president mentioned.
From stories of grief, we've seen so many stories of hope and heroism, of the aloha spirit. Every emergency responder put their lives on the line for us, save others. Everyday heroes, neighbors helping neighbors, Native Hawaiian leaders offering solace and strength. That's Maui. That's America. And to the people of Hawaii, we're with you for as long as it takes, I promise you.
Search teams have turned their attention from single-story residential properties to multi-story residential and commercial buildings as they continue their attempts to find the missing. With nearly 80% of structures in Lahaina destroyed, thousands have no home and no possessions. If you would like to help the relief efforts on Maui, EWTN News in Depth was given this website address during our program last week by Bishop Larry Silva of the Honolulu Diocese, which covers all of Hawaii. Help diocese relief efforts at tinyurl.com, Maui Catholic. The first tropical storm to hit Southern California in nearly 85 years drenched the state with record-breaking rainfall. Hurricane Hilary barreled ashore in Baja California, Mexico, and then was downgraded to a tropical storm as it hit Los Angeles County and the desert regions beyond. One of the hardest hit areas, Palm Springs, California, where half a year's worth of rain fell in just a six-hour period. The downpour caused flooding, mudslides, and debris flows. Roadways were damaged and vehicles stranded. It was the first time the National Hurricane Center ever issued a tropical storm warning for Southern California. Concern about increasing incidents of extreme weather, the environment, and ecology have been a signature issue for Pope Francis during his papacy. Now, a surprise announcement this week from the Pope himself that he will be writing a second part of his landmark encyclical, Laudato Si, released in 2015. The document also has much to say about human dignity, ethics, and the connection between environmental and social issues. To discuss this week's announcement of an addition to the original Laudato Si, we're joined by Hannah Brockhaus, senior Rome correspondent for the Catholic News Agency. She joins us from our Vatican Bureau. Hannah, great to see you. Do we know what Pope Francis is planning to focus on in this second part of Laudato Si?
Well, Monse, unfortunately, we don't yet have a lot of details about what the document will include or exactly when it will be released. We just know the Pope wants to focus on recent environmental crises. So we can kind of imagine what it might talk about. Of course, our minds go to the recent devastating fires in Hawaii, as well as in Canada and in recent years in California. Of course, also earlier this year, Pope Francis visited South Sudan. And in that country, they have experienced a lot of problems with drought and that affecting crops, as well as flooding that has created increased illnesses, spread illnesses in the country. So there's a lot of displacement in that country due to environmental related causes.
Now, Laudato Si is much more than an encyclical, and your experience there at the Vatican, it's also an action platform within the Vatican under the Dicastery for the Promotion of Integral Human Development. Tell us more about what that does.
Yeah, Pope Francis established that dicastery 1 year after he released Laudato Si. And within that dicastery, there's a permanent commission for ecology. So that commission is spearheads a lot of the Vatican's initiatives, which there are many, focused on the environment, on ecology, on care for creation. They collaborate as well with the Laudato Si movement in a week-long celebration of Laudato Si, which encourages, obviously, everyone doing their part to help the environment. And then Pope Francis also established in 2015, on September 1st, the celebration of the World Day of Care for Creation. So a prayer for care for creation. So obviously an encouragement for Catholics to join with Orthodox Christians who also celebrate the same day to spend a special day focused on praying for our environment.
A nice moment of Christian unity. In addition to care for our common home or care for the environment, the original encyclical also addressed the dignity and defense of human life at the beginning and end of life. Might the Holy Father's advocacy for migrants be included in this next letter?
I think that that's a distinct possibility, especially given the Pope's sensitivity to how much of migration and the refugee crisis is linked back to environmental changes, which have caused people to seek, you know, better lives in other places. It's obviously also really linked to human trafficking. The Pope mentioned that in Laudato Si, the problem of desperate people being taken advantage of. We see that right now, especially in Italy, because there are so many migrants who are being brought across in dangerous situations across the Mediterranean Sea. Many of them have lost their lives, unfortunately, trying to make that treacherous trip in from Africa to arrive in Europe, to arrive in Italy. And Pope Francis himself very recently spoke out against that, and they take advantage of people in difficult circumstances. Human traffickers do. And then the fact that just so many people have died, and that's something that we need to pay attention to. And how can we help them so that people don't feel forced to seek a better life away from their homes?
Right, so they can stay where they are. Well, let's see if he repeats the release next spring. We'll be praying for that. Thanks so much, Hannah. A victory for pro-life advocates in South Carolina. The state Supreme Court on Wednesday upheld the state's new abortion law, which bans abortion after cardiac activity can be detected around 6 weeks of pregnancy. Until now, South Carolina had allowed abortion until 22 weeks. The law was rewritten after the court blocked a similar law in January. The justice who wrote that opinion retired, and with a new court makeup, the legislature tried again and passed the new law during a rare special session. The six-week ban goes into effect immediately. Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone of San Francisco has announced the archdiocese is declaring bankruptcy in the face of more than 500 lawsuits alleging clerical sexual abuse.
After much reflection, prayer, and consultation with our financial and legal advisors, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of San Francisco filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization. We believe the bankruptcy process is the best way to provide a compassionate and equitable solution for survivors of abuse, while ensuring that we continue the vital ministries to the faithful and to the communities that rely on our services and charity.
Corleone said most of the clerical abuse occurred in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, and involved priests who are now either deceased or no longer in ministry. He assured his parishioners church offerings will not be used to settle abuse claims. He also said the bankruptcy would not affect individual parishes or schools.
Well, my church is a synodal church. The Maronite Church is governed by synod. But there's some positives and negatives there.
Getting a better understanding of the Eastern Rite Catholic Churches and their role in the upcoming Synod on Synodality next.
I was obviously very flattered that the bishops elected me to be one of the five representatives from the U.S. And it'll be my first experience actually participating in a synod.
Voting in the upcoming Synod on Synodality in Rome this October. EWTN News In Depth launched our EWTN News Synodal Series last week with several interviews I conducted with bishops and archbishops. I asked for their perspectives and why Catholics should care about this worldwide undertaking where clergy and lay people will consider the future of the church. This week, we focus on the contributions of the Eastern Rite churches to the Synod on Synodality. Of the 1.3 billion Catholics in communion with the Holy Father, about 18 million are members of Eastern churches, a distinct minority within the Catholic Church. There are 23 Eastern Catholic churches, including Maronite, Melkite, Ukrainian, Ethiopian, Syro-Malabar, Coptic, and Chaldean. Each church has its own leadership figure that typically goes by a title like Metropolitan, Patriarch, or Major Archbishop. They hold their own synods, which behave as governing bodies electing their own hierarchy. They also have their own liturgies, and they keep their original ethnic and historical traditions. But they all recognize the Pope as the head of the church. Despite their autonomy, Pope Francis can still amend canon law in a way that affects them. In April, just this year, in a motu proprio, Iam Pridem, the Holy Father introduced a limit of 80 years of age for retired bishops and patriarchies to take part in decisional voting. There was no limit before that for Eastern Rite churches. He mentioned that he did this after listening to the many members of the Eastern Rite and the needs of their communities. Bishop Gregory Mansour, the Eparch of the Maronite Eparchy of St. Maron in Brooklyn, New York, shared his expectations of the role Eastern Rite Catholics will play in the upcoming Synod in Rome.
Another way that we come together as a model is with the Eastern churches, and
yes.
I know that we're going to learn a lot from them in the Synod.
Yes.
Talk to me about why the Synod is so important and how the Eastern Church is a model for us.
Well, my church is a synodal church. The Maronite Church is governed by synod. But there's some positives and negatives there, because a beautiful teamwork that, but sometimes you need the hierarchical structure that we have in the Latin church of a pope kind of guiding us forward. And that's a beautiful characteristic. In the Catholic Church, we still have Peter in the person of Pope Francis. And even though you have 23 Eastern churches and the one Latin church, we're all in harmonious, kind of harmonious, working with Peter. And I think the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox, as well as the Assyrian churches of Iraq and the Middle East, are looking to the Synod to say, hey, listen, you're trying to govern yourself a little bit more like we govern ourselves. And here are the positive things about our synodal, but we as non-Catholics see the beauty of your organization, of your governance. So my hope is that our governance as the Catholic Church, we won't lose that synodality approach, and we won't lose that the Peter's the last word, and Peter can make the decisions for us to move forward.
And are they
does
well?
That make sense?
It makes perfect sense. But
yeah.
are the Eastern churches well represented enough to be able to make those points?
They are fairly. I don't know if the Orthodox or the Oriental or the because there's different. There's the Assyrians, there's the Oriental Orthodox, and then there's the Eastern Orthodox. And so I don't know if those have been represented well enough in the Synod. But I think they're all watching. and their counterparts who are Catholic are watching.
Well, we'll be praying for that. That's a beautiful sentiment. Thank you so much,
you're
Bishop.
You're welcome.
Metropolitan Archbishop William Skirla of the Byzantine Catholic Church in the United States and Canada will be a voting member of the Synod. He joins us now to provide more insight on the impact of the Eastern Catholic Churches in this upcoming meeting in the Vatican. Thank you so much for joining us, Archbishop. What does synodality mean to you and your church, and how does it affect how you govern yourselves since Eastern Rite churches use a synodal model?
Mm-hmm. Well, as Bishop Mansour mentioned, you know, each of the different levels of churches, and we're a particular church within Rome, but our structure would be a metropolitan church. And as the metropolitan archbishop, I'm the head of our particular church in the United States and Canada. And it means that we gather together, you know, four times a year to make decisions, and each bishop within the we would not call it a synod, but we would call it the Council of Hierarchs. It has a vote in kind of directing the affairs of the churches in the United States and Canada.
So that's very practical, yeah. which is great. Who gets to attend then these councils? I know that we're having some discussions around lay people and women. Who actually gets to attend?
The Council of Hierarch meetings are one level of synodality, and that's mostly just for the bishops and any people that we need to have come in to make reports and have usually a secretary to take notes for that. On the level of laity and religious and clergy, we would have the assemblies, and those are both within the Metropolitan Church and also at the eparchial or diocesan level. And for those meetings, the archbishops, bishops, clergy, religious and laity all attend, and they all have voice at the meeting.
And in attending and in having a voice at the meeting, do they have votes that are available to them, or is this just a listening session where reports are read and recommendations are taken?
I think for the most part, it depends on the particular nature of the meeting. Some are more informational and some are more, to come to a decision on important issues. And on those, usually they do take a vote and to take a poll as to see what the bishops and then also the clergy, religious and laity think. And as with the Synod, within any of the Catholic churches, the ultimate authority relies in the head of the church. And the larger Catholic church, that would be the Pope, and in the metropolitan level, it would be myself and kind of guiding those votes.
Okay. So there is guidance from the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And then, I'm interested in this just because it's moving so quickly within the Catholic Church. In this synodal, the Synod on Synodality really is this listening moment that has made its way through the parishes and now all the way up to Rome, with this gathering starting in a couple of weeks. And for us, it is different to think about laity voting. What is the impact of those votes for your church?
For us, it does give us some. Kind of when we decide to set policy within our particular church, either in terms of the liturgy or different administrative things that we have, it does kind of becomes binding, for the different bishops and clergy and laity within the Metropolitan Church.
So,
and at the Synod, in the past Synods, this will be my third Synod that I'm attending as the Metropolitan Archbishop. I did the preparations for another one. And each time that we gather, the laity do have a voice at the meeting. They do make presentations. And the difference is that they'll have a vote. But even that vote is consultative to the Holy Father. And, he has, he can listen to or amend what he wants out of the final document of the Synod.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense to us. So then, what have you seen over time in attending these synods? Has the Latin Church adopted this way of being synodal, and is this a radical move, or has this progressively happened over time with the synods since the Second Vatican Council?
I think they have been present, and not only for the lay people, and I think Bishop Mansour mentioned that other Eastern churches do attend, and the Orthodox do attend the meetings, and the last couple I've sat next to the representative from the Russian Orthodox Church, and they do listen to what they say, and it does influence the form of the document that's given to the Holy Father.
And Archbishop, then, understanding that these gatherings to have input on do have input on church governance, and that does land on Pope Francis's desk, what do you hope that the Latin Church will learn from the Eastern Catholics?
Well, to realize it is a serious process, and that all the voices are heard, and as you mentioned in kind of the changing of the age limits for the patriarchs and for bishops within the Eastern churches, the Holy Father does take those recommendations and uses it to apply to future changes in policy for all the Catholic churches and also for the rules and regulations that affect individual particular churches in the Eastern Catholic Communion.
I have one last question for you, and it's mostly about the fears of people who are watching the synodal process and don't understand it. There are big fears around whether church teaching will be changed on marriage or on human sexuality or on the diaconate and women. Are those fears well-founded, or is this something that has been brought up in Eastern synods where you would say, yes, we've done this before and we want to teach you how to do this, or no, this is really about bringing people together within the orthodoxy of what we understand church teaching and the truth really is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in our particular case, we're a church in the United States, so we have the extremes from one end of the spectrum to the other, and you have to make a decision somewhere along the line. And as Bishop Mansour had mentioned, you have to have somebody that ultimately says yes or no to which direction the church takes. And that is the process. The synodal process is consultative. It takes a wide range of from the far right to the far left and brings them together, not only from just the Roman Catholic Church, but from all the Eastern churches and also the Orthodox and Protestant denominations that come to the Synod and have a presentation and voice at the Synod also. And it's a process that, it's left up to the wisdom of the Holy Father and guided not by just what, the Pope wishes to do, but it's guided by our traditions in the Catholic magisterium and tradition that goes back to the divine revelation of Christ. And that's what we try to do. And we hope to mirror that, through and more faithfully respond to what the Lord is calling us to do. And just for everybody that's worried about it, just to pray and to pray that the Holy Spirit guides the process and brings it to what the Lord wants for his church in this world.
A beautiful pastoral response and a reminder that I received from your brother bishops as well, asking all of the laity to pray for this process. Thank you so much, Archbishop.
Okay, thank you.
I think Jesus is just inviting people to this relationship with him personally in the Eucharist.
When we come back, details on the upcoming Eucharistic revival and how you can get involved.
Restoring understanding of and devotion to the Blessed Sacrament. As we reported to you a little more than a year ago, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops hopes to spark a renewed love for Jesus' presence in the bread and wine through the National Eucharistic Revival. Right now, we're in the parish phase of the multi-year event aimed at fostering Eucharistic devotion and strengthening liturgical life at the parish level. Bishop Andrew Cousins of the Diocese of Crookston, Minnesota, is chairman of the board of the National Eucharistic Congress. In a recent interview, he shared a rare insight. It's not just the faithful, but also the clergy who are learning more and more about the church through this revival process.
We've been doing a lot of different things in the Diocese of Crookston. We're a small diocese, but it's really a great place to try to implement some of what we're trying to do nationally with Eucharistic Revival. So we're just beginning the parish here. We're going to do a five-week preaching series on the Eucharist. So I've changed the readings for all of October. A bishop can do this, I found
out. Yeah, that's cool.
So all the readings will be about the Eucharist for 5 weeks in October, which is kind of the time when most people come to church, you know? I mean, it shouldn't be that way, but that's the way it is. And so for 5 weeks, every parish is going to preach on the Eucharist, different aspects. And I'm just working out now what those aspects will be each week, a different aspect of the Eucharist. We want to give good education, but we also want to provide these opportunities for an encounter, because we know it's actually that movement of the heart that makes the difference.
An EWTN News Real Clear Opinion research poll found that only 50% of respondents say they believe in the real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist. While the revival aims to teach, Bishop Cousins shares that the real hope is that the faithful learn to build a personal relationship with Jesus.
The Eucharistic revival is all about helping people have this encounter, right? In that way, it very much flows from Pope Francis's Evangelium Vitae, like this movement of encounter, which is life-changing. And that's what you see in the Bible, right? When people encounter the living Jesus, it changes their life. It's what Pope Benedict said. When you have an encounter with Christ, it gives your life a new horizon, a new direction. And so this is really our goal in the Eucharistic revival, is to both create experiences, so both in community but also in prayer, where people can have that encounter.
Tim Glimkowski is the executive director of the National Eucharistic Congress. We sat down to talk about the vision to strengthen people's relationship with Christ.
Tim, it's so great to be here with you to chat about the Eucharistic revival, of which you are the head. Tell me how that came about.
Yeah, well, so I was part of the Committee on Evangelization with Bishop Cousins that launched this work. And I mean, simply put, I just felt really called to it. I felt like God was doing something in the church unique right now, and honored kind of to be a part of it.
Now, people hear about the revival, they hear about the Congress. Explain the two things to us.
Yeah, sure. So the revival is the three-year movement. Every parish, every diocese, every apostolate focusing on how we rekindle a living relationship with Jesus in the Eucharist. But we think every movement, which we see the Eucharistic revival as sort of a movement of renewal in the church, needs a moment, needs a time to gather all together. And so the 10th National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis, July 17th through 21st, 2024, next summer, is really that moment. This is the first one we've done as a country in 83 years. Other countries do these every 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really bringing back a tradition as sort of the central point that everything kind of moves toward and moves away from.
There was just an African Eucharistic revival in D.C. that we covered and we were very excited about. And we've kind of felt like we were receiving another gift from our African brothers and sisters to encourage us in this encounter. Are you seeing something like that as well, where it's global in addition to being local?
Yeah, we hear from people all over the place that are really excited about what they're seeing from the United States. I get emails all the time from people around the world talking about the National Eucharistic Congress that's coming up, and they're excited. And yeah, this is really something that we've, I think, lost as a country. And we're grateful for the gifts of people kind of inspiring a renewed focus on that here in the United States.
Now, because you were part of the committee, you understand the heart of this work. You remember the conversations that the bishops had around people not really understanding what the real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist is. But Bishop Cousins has started talking about really it being more about just having a relationship with Jesus Christ first. Is that really something that you're discovering as you do this work?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's really, belief is a complex reality. And I think the heart of really what God is doing to bring renewal in the church in general right now is through a renewed encounter with Jesus in the Eucharist. And so, yeah, we see this as more than just kind of a catechetical initiative, sort of articulating the doctrine in a new way. We see it as God doing something to renew the church in her heart through a rekindled relationship with Jesus in the Eucharist. And that's really what we're seeing. I just talked to someone this morning who they set up a deanery, the Waco Deanery in Texas, set up a Eucharistic procession, and they were amazed. It was like pouring out the door. Like, people are hungry for something. There's a moment, a timeliness in our culture where people are really looking for this kind of renewal.
Now, Tim, one thing is habits, right? We go to church because that's what we do on Sundays, because we're Christians. Okay, but then there's really this belief that pours out of the organ of faith, which is the heart. Mm. Have you seen that change even within the Eucharistic Revival and Congress teams, where they're discovering something different about how they see Jesus Christ in their lives?
That's such a good question. Yeah, absolutely. I would say that's actually been the most unexpected part of this in my own life, has been it's the classic, like, God called me to a mission. Mm. But what I've discovered is he's actually calling me to himself through that mission in a new way. And I mean, I could tell you a million stories, but like, absolutely. And kind of in a crazy way, we feel sometimes, like, we joke, we feel like The Chosen or something, like the TV show, like, where we've just kind of been like brought into this work, and everyone's got their own unique story of it. And the way he's pulling us all close.
Now, Tim, because you were part of this committee, you understand what the bishops were struggling with. They were struggling with the lack of engagement or the understanding of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist, the real presence. But did we learn something different during COVID, that it was really that they weren't encountering someone in the Mass? They had the habits of the Catholic tradition and the Christian beliefs, but they weren't actually encountering Jesus Christ. They didn't have that relationship. Are you finding that that is something that your team is also discovering?
Yeah, I'd say that's very much so become the focus of the revival. Yeah, broadly for everyone else and for us personally too, is that I think Jesus is just inviting people to this relationship with him personally in the Eucharist. And that really covers a multitude of sins. You know, like, that's really the beginning point. Pope Benedict XVI in his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, said, being Christian is not the result of an ethical choice, like just a morality that I live, or a lofty ideal, a philosophical system, but it's the fruit of an encounter with a person.
Yes.
And there's a person in the Eucharist, and that's what this Eucharistic revival has become about, is meeting that person.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, you're taking us to Indianapolis a year from now.
Can't
right?
Wait.
You kicked off the countdown. It's already past a year from now. Why Indianapolis?
Yeah, it's central. The crossroads of America, the heartland, you know, and a great city to welcome a lot of people. They're used to NCYC events there, and they're used to the Super Bowl, you know. And so to have Lucas Oil Stadium and the convention center, the hotels surrounding it, just be so ready to prepare to receive so many Catholics, the city is pumped. They can't wait.
And a lot of people think, well, why is this for me? Am I supposed to go? Or is it just supposed to be my bishop or my priest or the head of, you know, faith formation, whatever? Who's it for?
Yeah, it's a good question. We get that question a lot. I mean, it really is for every Catholic in so many ways. Whoever wants to encounter Jesus in the Eucharist and be part of a historic moment, it's for them. There's diocesan delegations. We've already sold about 25,000 passes. Mm. And really what the story that we're telling now to the church is, this is really for every parish. The Congress is about local renewal. It's about people coming to this gathering, encountering Jesus, and then being sent back to their local parish to bring the seeds of renewal to the local church there. And so we want to challenge and invite every pastor in the United States to look at his parish, whether it's three people or whether it's 72, to say, who is God inviting on mission with me? And then to bring them to Indianapolis with him, you know, and to make that commitment as a parish. And we're working on sort of, you know, scholarships and alternative housing options to make it as accessible as possible. But that's really what we'd love to see, is every parish in the United States represented at this moment.
That's beautiful. Well, what comes next?
Yeah, well, this year is the parish year of revival. We've got 3,300 parish point persons already moving, bringing revival to their parish. And then it's the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage in May.
Yes.
Two months of four routes walking across the United States with Jesus in the Eucharist. And then that Congress moment. But the Congress isn't the end. It's the beginning of the year of mission, where we send Eucharistic missionaries out. So we're really, in so many ways, still at the beginning of the Eucharistic revival. We've just finished year one of three. And so more surprises from God in store, I would imagine.
It almost feels like it's a transformation in the way that we live as church in the United States.
Yeah, that's really well said. Yeah, that's exactly it.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Monty. Thanks for having me.
EWTN has been providing updates on the Eucharistic Revival since it kicked off, with multiple interviews with leaders and participants of this multi-year event. As a media sponsor, we will be on the ground covering the historic first-ever National Eucharistic Pilgrimages that begin in May of next year. EWTN will be following families on the various routes across the country who are making their way to the Eucharistic Congress that will be held in Indianapolis. The historic Congress is one at the start of the most important parts of the revival, going out on mission to evangelize the country and bringing everyone to Jesus. And another event you should mark your calendars for is the EWTN Family Celebration, which is Saturday, August 26th, and it's free. All of your favorite EWTN hosts will be there, including Father Joseph Wolf, Jim and Joy Pinto, Father Mitch Pacwa, and our CEO, Michael Warsaw. There will be talks, interactive displays, a rosary led by the Franciscan missionaries of the Eternal Word, Mass, and a Eucharistic procession. You can register online. Again, the event is free. So if you are in the Birmingham, Alabama area, head over to the Birmingham Jefferson Convention Complex to check it out. That's our program for today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Montse Alvarado. We invite you to join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.